Renaissance, Hiram Hayden, as a brief dedicatory note, through several people, including his father. He encouraged his father, he says, because his father was a university professor, who each year tore up the past year's notes so that he would be sure not to give any stale material to his students. This, of course, indicates the need, which is really the source of the life of history, the need which every age has to rethink the history of the past. We always have new questions we want to ask that earlier ages have not thought of asking about the past. As we've rethought the question of the ancient world, the medieval world, and the modern world, we have of late, by a kind of general consensus, moved the critical division forward toward our time. It's becoming more and more useful, we find, to consider as the great division in history not the 16th century, but the 17th century. The Renaissance has become a little more modern, perhaps. At any rate, the paper which we have here today certainly is a good paper to be situated in this joint meeting of the Central Renaissance Conference and the Judeo-Christian Studies Institute. For those of you who don't know, the Judeo-Christian Studies Institute is a local group, as against the Central Renaissance Conference, which is regional, made up of people from the two universities and the various colleges in the greater St. Louis area. This is really the first meeting apart from the organizational meeting which was held last year. And at this moment, although he doesn't know I'm going to do it, I would like, on behalf of those who've been involved with the Judeo-Christian Studies Institute, to publicly thank Professor Welkin of Washington University, who has been instrumental, has been the big spark in getting this institute together. Now, I'd like to ask you to give him a little hand. It is the plan for this institute to meet in this area, well, let's say periodically, perhaps annually, semi-annually, we just don't know. Our speaker this morning comes to us from the University of Wisconsin, where he is professor of history. I needn't go into detail about his biography and his work. Most of you, I'm sure, are familiar with both the man and his writings. He did his bachelor's degree. He was born in Germany. He did his bachelor's degree at Haverford College and his doctorate at Harvard. He was taught at the University of Michigan, Iowa, and Wisconsin. He was visiting Oxford with the United States High Commission in Germany in 1951 and 54. He's been active in work on the history of the Reformation and European intellectual history, and is well known particularly for his textbook, The Reformation, and for another book into which I understand he is going to talk this morning, The Holy Pretext, Christianity and Reason of State. It's a great pleasure, then, that I present our speaker on the subject, Religion and Materialism in 17th Century England, Professor George Mosser of the University of Wisconsin.
I'm very honored that you asked me to speak this morning to this joint session, and I'm especially glad to pull together my thoughts on the subject of religion and materialism for this occasion. And you must understand from the beginning that this is kind of a new subject, and that in talking to you, I cannot give all the documentation which I should, and it's especially the rather unorthodox interpretations that I should put forward require. But there will be a question period afterwards, which I hope will be extremely lively. For I do believe that it is something better than to give you a kind of definitive talk, if there is such a thing in history as a definitive talk, which is doubtful, but rather, if you are interested in the subject, to spur some of you on for an investigation, or to join me in the quest to investigate it. For the history of materialism is, oddly enough, a very neglected field, though we should obviously also all be interested in it. And I think it is most fruitful for a conference of this sort to be a little experimental. But as I said, not only do I doubt, really, that you can say anything very definitive about history, but I doubt especially that you can say anything very definite about the Puritans with which I'm dealing today. Now, in his book entitled The Holy Family, Karl Marx wrote that the original home of modern materialism from the 17th century on was England. And he goes on to link this materialism to the thought of Francis Bacon, of Thomas Hobbes. But he is also concerned in the Holy Family with the background of medieval nominalism. And in the course of the discussion of John Scotus in particular, Karl Marx wrote that he forced theology itself to preach materialism. And in a sense, this phrase sums up the central concern of what I have to say this morning. For it is from the vantage point of religious thought that a new and important insight into the growth of modern materialism can, I think, be gained. And this cannot be associated solely with men like Bacon and Hobbes, something which not only Marx, but also modern historians have made the focus of their analysis. Moreover, considering the growth of 17th century English materialism through an examination of religious thought, not only opens up new and fruitful fields of investigation, but it also brings such ideas down to the level of popular thought or popular piety. To be sure, this materialism has little in common with the historical materialism as Engels defined it, that is to say, the search for ultimate causes in the economic development of society. Indeed, Engels, in his introduction to socialism, scientific or utopian, spends much of his time criticizing those agnostics with which I am going to deal, namely those who remove God from the world of man while still retaining him as the ultimate cause of things. This change-based materialism, as he calls it, while retaining a vague belief in God, held that the entire natural world is governed by law and absolutely excludes the intervention of action from without. According to this definition, the materialism with which we are concerned is indeed change-based. Engels has, in fact, given a perfect definition of it. Yet for all this, it was a materialism, and one which can be traced to tendencies of the religious thought of the age. And I think that without it, we lack a vital stage in the growth or history of materialism itself. If Marx and Engels' analysis of English materialism of the 17th century was faulty in this regard, so has been the recognition of this by modern historians. At most, they have concentrated upon the growth of the idea of reason of state and the secularization of political thought. And yet, the 17th century was the beginning not only what Engels called agnosticism, but also of a consciously directed anti-Christian movement. With few exceptions, it has been framed to Italian historians who have dealt with this phenomenon. Perhaps the term liberty now, under which this anti-Christian movement failed, misdirected historians, who have seen here merely a group of men who sought the indignant Father Darras, summed up in 1623 under the title of La Doctrine Curieuse. We can outline such ideas briefly. The substitution of the primacy of nature for a God active in this world, The belief that man's soul is wholly mortal, combined with the rejection of Christ's immediate redemptive task in this world. The pamphlet called The Three Impostors, which had a wide circulation in the century, in England and in Europe, is representative of this. For here, Moses, Mohammed, and Christ were all held to be false prophets. The centers of this movement were in Paris and Venice, and such regions as the Languedoc in France also held many adherents. Now it is England which must concern us. But it is important to realize that 17th century Europe had a vigorous movement of this nature. Like all such trends, it at first took the form of coterie, but then proceeded to spread more widely, as Giorgio Spini and René Pintar have shown. Yet England surely was different from Venice and France. Christian caused a revolution, usually called Puritan. Moreover, very few references can be found in English literature to the so-called atheists, which were causing such a stir abroad. This, however, again, must not mislead us. A comparison between this thought on the continent and in England does bring out many similarities between them, even if direct connection may have been slight. Seen from this point of view, it becomes obvious that the European-wide anti-Christian movement embraced England as well, and this particularly through several tendencies in Puritan thought. Four interrelated trends of religious ideology must hold our attention here. The inner directedness of the Puritan radical, the concepts of providence and human opportunity, and in a larger sense, the deism and casualty connected with these. If we take the Verinnerlichung first, many remarks made by Johannes Kuhn about the continent will apply to England as well. Mysticism dissolves the difference between nature and revelation, for all was revelation, from God to the leaves of a plant. Moreover, truth in religion was not something firmly possessed, but an ideal towards which man strove. Thus, religious truth became something that was relativistic. Such ideas constantly entered the work of the Puritan radical prophet of Puritan England, but they did so in a special manner. For them also the truth of God encompassed all of nature. The Ranters, the most important text, wanted to live, as they put it, in tune with creation, and this came to mean surpassing existing and assumed religious forms, as embodied in Orthodox Christianity. But at the same time, this led the Ranters towards the acceptance of a thoroughgoing deism. This deism, in turn, led them to divide God from the world as it was constituted. God was so glorious, so transcendent, that the dead elements could not originate from him. Earth and water are uncreated substances, eternally distinct from the God of glory. Man himself became involved in this distinction. He was sinful and evil, and thus could not be linked to God through his soul. Eventually, the Ramsha prophet, Muddleton and Greaves, posited two worlds which existed apart from each other, that of heaven and that of the earth. The golden chain of being was ruptured, except for the prophets themselves, who had gotten divine insight through a direct revelation. But the ordinary man, in the here and now, was sufficient unto himself. Even in death, man would merely sleep. His soul was mortal until the last judgment. When man died, they said, his soul was extinguished, as fire goes out in an oven that is closed, until the visible coming of the Lord of Life in the clouds of heaven on the last day. Significantly, Muddleton and Greaves went on to assert that the body cannot exist without the spirit, and all the spirit without the body, and so both must perish together. This is, of course, a rather ancient heresy, But the two prophets did not arrive at this heresy, who rated Aristotle, as did some of their continental contemporaries, but instead to the exalted view of God, the unclean spirit of the soul living in the body of man can never be likened to the spirit of God. Here the accentuated glory of God resulted in a materialist view of man. What had begun as mysticism ended up in this fashion. Ernst Troeltsch pointed out long ago that there is an affinity between mysticism and rationalism, and this can be illustrated in Puritan England to a man like Gerard Winstanley. But with the Ranter, this affinity was not with rationalism, but instead with a materialistic view of man, which postponed an essentially apocalyptic view of life to the final end of the last judgment. These ideas were by no means confined to the Ranter. They were also typical of what is called the soul sleeper. This was a more widely held belief than the definable text of the Ranter. Calvin wrote his first tract against the soul sleeper, and they can be traced in Puritan England, though much more work on the diffusion of the ideas must be done. The coinciding of the ideas of the soul sleepers with those of the Ranters leads to the conclusion that the thought of mothers and dreams had a wider dissemination than that given to the specific text which they had it. Moreover, such trends of thought could excite a great deal of attention in England at mid-century. One critic called men of this stamp simply the heathen, for they hold there is a God, and they fear that God, but they hold that he is so majestical and proud that he will not meddle with men. Therefore they live very beast-like. That this was a development most prominent among the radicals, and that it was connected with their nature mysticism, he does not say. These Puritans were the simple and unlettered kind who sought an explanation for the glory of God, and by contrast, for their own depressed and wretched condition. Such thought led the Ranters to lay stress upon providence. One pamphlet written against them puts it very well. They believed that there was no God, no heaven, no hell, but that creation came by providence. They did, of course, believe in God, but they believed in the existence of heaven and hell only at the final judgment. Ranters held that providence governed the world, but that providence was not expressed through a God working in the world, but through nature. This, however, not in the Platonic sense of God conceived as an invisible spirit dwelling in creation, a position which Madison and Reeves explicitly condemned in favor of a distinct personal God upon the throne of his glory in the heavens above the stars. But God so conceived is far removed from nature. There is here none of that bifurcation of life popular with many Renaissance thinkers who made a distinction between man's secular and natural life, which was under faith, and his divine or rational life, which was under providence. With the Ranters, all life was secular and self-generated, governed by faith expressed through nature. But this, in turn, was seen through nature as through a broken mirror, because nature also shared the corruption which was part of the earthly world. Once again, this led them to proclaim man's total self-sufficiency, and typical of this was the statement that man was propagated by man without the intervention of any divine spark. One hitherto ill-explained phenomena is related to this finite concept of nature, the interest in astrology. There were numerous radicals who passed either from Ranterism into a preoccupation with astrology, or who reversed this process. The astrology to which such men paid allegiance was not the astrology of a man, let us say, like Thomas Campanella, who thought that the contrasting principles of heaven and earth formed a unity. Instead, they believed that the stars were instruments of finite nature only. The most interesting of such men was Lawrence Krauss, who left us a detailed account of his peregrination, in which what he calls his astrological theory. He came to believe that there was no devil, nor indeed no God, but only nature. Nor had any specific act of creation taken place. Interestingly enough, he preached this view throughout England, for example, in Snepham in Norfolk, where I was by all the towns well received. When you tabulate all the evidence for the popularity of such thought, of mantra-raising, of soul sleeping, we may well wonder how deep such ideas ran. What was on the continent the sort of sophisticated university or court intellectual was in England built upon the lower classes of the population. I am inclined to think an integral element of their popular piety. Now, Clarkson became a writer and thus was able to combine his concept of nature with a final religious and Christian end postponed to the last judgment. As I have shown elsewhere, so I won't go into it now, Richard Overton's ideas can only be understood in the context of this thought. Thus nature became the visible and concrete providence. This did not lead to stoic resignation here, as it might well have done, but instead to the worship of a prophet, who alone had been given the ultimate truth through a personal revelation. For mothers and engineers, the finite material world had been sealed at a certain day, hour, and indeed minute in a revelation forever withheld from the rest of material man. The step upon providence was not confined to Puritans of this sort. In England, it became a vital ingredient of what René Pintard calls in his fundamental book on the libertines as the main characteristic of continental libertinism, interior audacity combined with outward circumspection. This in turn led to a divorce between thought and action, heart and word, as the situation demanded. Such purity present a more complex ideology than the radical. However, they also come close to dividing the earthly from the divine. They do this in a more indirect and ambiguous fashion than with their radical and lower class contemporaries. For this kind of purity, the idea of the overriding good of God's providence led them to discount individual action in the name of a general and future goal which God had laid down. Robert Preston, the master of Emmanuel, the Puritan College of Cambridge, sums it up. Let no man judge himself or others by a step or two, nor by a few actions. Outward occasions are transitory. What is important is the frame of the heart. For it alone knew what God had decreed in his providence. For the writer, God in Christ's task was postponed until the last judgment. For such purity to question, this task was constantly before man. But its effectiveness in this world came only with the achievement of the end goal providence laid down. In the meanwhile, human actions have an autonomy which in effect divides them from the final goal towards which they are directed. I have shown in the Holy Pretense how this resulted in biblical interpretation, which condoned as mere outward and worldly acts such difficult scriptural events as Joshua's famous ambush at Ai. Such an attitude also serves to justify stratagem in politics and especially in war. As long as the ultimate aim of God's providence was kept in view, actions which led to success in terms of this world became self-justified. As the army chaplain John Dell put it, we may judge of our calling in business by the power we have received from Christ to it, by our success. In other words, nothing succeeds like success. This attitude towards individual action was further strengthened by the pragmatism which grew out of such a reading of Providence. To act became all important. Without practice, all is nothing, John Dowman cautions his readers. And he cautions them not to rely upon idle wishes, instead to use all help to need, which may enable us unto godliness. The means and ends go together, and it will not do to wait for the fulfillment of one without using the other. Individual action assumes great importance, at the same time as the goal of that action, the fulfillment of God's providence, became increasingly a matter of intention, viewed in a general and internalized way. As Sir Henry Vane said, the goodness of my cause is not merely to be judged by the event, but by the righteousness of its principle. William Goodwin, albeit an unorthodox Puritan, stated this still more bluntly: whatsoever directly and evidently tends to the affecting of that which is good must needs be good, and therefore from God. From such ideas it was merely a step to make outward acts relate solely to reason and nature. During the debate of the Westminster Assembly, the quite orthodox Mr. Palmer took just this step. An issue was the administration of a formula to prove a person's orthodoxy. Palmer maintained that the rules of reason and nature do regulate the matter and managing of it, but the sanctity of God does that is because it is for edification so very much. As taken in this world, we're increasingly divorced from the frame of the house, which was interested only in the final goal. Stoic influences may well have reinforced this point of view. Thomas Gattaca, one of the main popularizers of Stoicism in England, pointed out that with the Stoic, a man of virtue and piety is always in a state of happiness, let the outward circumstances be what they will. Such downgrading and radical downgrading of outward reality as apart from the inner religious direction did come close to that divorce of the world from God which we have observed in the Rancour. The differentiation between interior audacity and outward circumspection was, however, made still more apparent by Puritan pragmatism than by Stoic influence. Not only the need for action, but also the importance of prudence occupied much of their attention. William Ames combined, typically enough, a stress upon God's ultimate purpose with an emphasis on those prudent actions which must change the world. This prudence meant circumspection and at times actions which, as he put it, sonare in malo. At the same time, such Puritans attempted to make divinity practical. This effort required precisely that distinction between the inner man and his external actions, which I have discussed. John Smith, for example, came to distinguish between divine life and divine science. They cannot be good at theory that are bad at practice. The parallel with Arminians, like Uten Bulbert, is striking, in spite of the Puritan abhorrence of that movement. For Smith also, divine life was valued above any dogma. Religious truth here becomes individualized, as man attained a religious self-sufficiency which tended to stress the pragmatic adjustment to the world more than the divine. Johannes Kuhn sums this up for England as well as for the continent with which he is concerned. Religious experience and the Christian worldview are no longer identical. For Puritan, this meant in religious terms a stress upon the coinciding of man's ultimate attention with the goal of God's providence. In secular terms, it meant a
reality of individual action within the reality of this world. Here, earthly reality overruled the standard of the divine. God provided the goal of providence and the opportunity to fulfill it, that man must measure his individual act against finite reality. Yet, these kind of purities were not here who substituted nature for divine providence. That's the scripture about the new deism, which is the most plausible competitor to Christianity. Certainly applies to the wanted. It did not apply to the man just discussed. They believed in the Trinity. Their point of departure was not a transcendent God who would have nothing to do with the corrupt world, but instead man's corruption and Christ's mediation. It was from this doctrine of original sin, especially, that they elaborated their thought. Their own view of human corruption led them to distinguish in their thought between the truly divine and the world below, for do not even the saints have their pattern. But here also, God did not intervene as long as the eventual goal of providence was fulfilled. The world had to be dealt with on its own terms. The end was the godly society, but the opportunity made available meant far-reaching adjustment to an earthly and finite situation. Peter Sterry spoke for many of his contemporaries when he wrote, "Vision, all learning and observation has been assumed the first and chief part of wisdom. To fix determinately, with full strength of inclination, thought, and contrivance, the end of every work. This means to dispose and direct all the means, efficaciously and infallibly towards those ends." The story of the Platonists and Platonic ideas undoubtedly enter into this thought. The English definition of the essence of Platonism makes this apparent. The recognition of an unseen world of unchanging reality behind the flux of phenomena, a spiritual universe compared with which the world of appearances grew pale and unsubstantial and became a symbol or even an illusion. Sterry undoubtedly was acquainted with Plato, but his attitude could be applied to all those who made the ends of providence primary to the moon, viewed man only subspecies eternitatis, discounted the importance of outward action, and by discounting it, made them really adjust to this world and finite. As one leading Calvinist put it so very nicely in one of my favorite quotations, if God came down to earth and sat around the table and confronted scoundrels, he would become a scoundrel himself. From this point ends, by the way, that this came before the Synod, and the Synod could not bring itself to condemn this point of view. A very important milestone, I think, in the history of this thought. From this point of view, then, Orthodox Puritanism also tended towards the divorce of earthly reality from heaven by turning towards practical, pragmatic, rather than transcendent concerns on the one hand, and on the other, by cross-dressing the end religious goal as to virtually divorce it from the events of human life. Both the Rampers and the Puritans just discussed believed in an ideal society. For the Rampers, that society would come about in the far distant future, in the time of the last judgment. Then divine justice would come, and the poor would be rescued from their undeserved fate. For the other Puritans, that society was also in the future, but it could be brought closer to the present through human action. Meanwhile, and this is what I think is important, for both of them, material reality dominated life until the reign of Christ on earth could be brought about. In both cases also, the emphasis upon the materialistic present came to be divorced from the final goal. For the Rampers, without doubt, completely so. For the other Puritans, it was a matter of degree. In this way, the Christian worldview was relegated to a future utopia and thus pushed out of life out of the life of the present. This may well be the crux of this whole development. Besides, Johannes came once more, for he comes to an identical conclusion from his examination of continental religious radicalism. What still remains vital in the Christian worldview retreated evermore into the pure realm of providence and feeling as upon a bed of rest. The despised radicals and their respectable fellow Puritans had this in common. That this should be the case must tell us something about the underlying direction of Puritanism. Hans Emil Weber, in his important book, Reformation, Orthodoxy, and Rationalismus, attempted to show the dissolution of the Reformation theology into rationalism. Not dissimilar, it could be shown at greater length than here, that Puritan theology at points dissolved into a naturalistic and even materialistic view of man, into that same-faced materialism which was mentioned at the beginning of this paper. It must be pointed out, however, that this development is not connected with that skepticism which was also a part of 17th century thought. These men did believe in God, and many of them in the Trinity. Such considerations make it important to realize that we are confronted here with a development from out of radical and indeed orthodox Puritan thought. It is no coincidence which made W. Stevens over a century later wonder as he accounted for the growth of theism in England. Stevens, he wrote, how theism could creep in upon us here, where the scriptures are made to public, and where so many treaties are written which so strongly assert their authority to be divine. Our analysis may have given him his answer. In a treatise probably written by John Downing in 1646, the modern atheist was meant to define the difference between the ancient atheist and himself. The ancient atheist did not believe in a God, but he did, and in providence besides. The new atheist rejected all dogma. The new and old testament were as the cunning princes who made scripture the color of all their enterprises. Such theism, but with all the thought discussed then, Downing described as atheism of a new stamp. He may well have been correct, for he was in general a most acute observer. This atheism was new in England, and this may have been so because it was a development from Puritan theology, a contribution of Puritanism to England not generally considered. It was certainly not new on the continent by the time Downing wrote. In France, for example, the famous Quatrain du Deus of 1622 had put forward the same kind of ideas which we found in the Rantes. In Germany, the Protestant Johann Sigloff in 1643 stated that God is completely divorced from man and the world through his analogical difference. The concept of man abandoned to himself in Tunisia runs through the work of Lucillo Vanilli of Venice and Cremonini of Padua, while the emphasis upon religious goals and the autonomy of human action figures among all the theological controversies of the 17th century. The conclusion seems inescapable that all of Europe was moving in the direction of the same-faced materialism which England talked about. While Tunisia, a religious revival was taking place in Catholicism and imminent in Protestantism. England participated in this movement, even while undergoing a Puritan revolution, or indeed because it was undergoing a Puritan experience. Such a revolutionary struggle was bound to emphasize the need for stratagems and policies, for actions which could not be called either Christian or moral. Small wonder that the Orthodox Puritans, who had struggled against powerful opposition from the Elizabethan age until victory was achieved, divorced the means from the end. They were troubled about it. We are no longer. I will never forget, if you don't mind me inducting a contemporary parallel. And when President Eisenhower was asked at the World Council of Churches several years ago how he could reconcile it with Christianity to build atomic H bombs to destroy people, he simply answered, well, we must have our feet on the ground and our heads in the cloud. What kind of answer would not have been satisfactory in the 17th century? And so I must say at once, these people were bothered by this rather fundamental problem, as perhaps moderns are no longer bothered by it. Anyway, in this real kind of revolutionary kind of a situation, it is small wonder then that the Puritans divorced the new from the old. At the same time, the new freedom granted to radicalism was bound to bring forward ideals which had been perceived endemic in popular thought for a century or more. Perhaps, of all that I have said, the more thoroughgoing materialistic outlook of the ranters and soul sleepers is of even greater importance than the same tendency among their respectable elders. For it illuminates, for one historical moment, the ideas and longings of what we might call with some justice the common people. And you can see how that would be, for how great indeed for them the actual difference between God and themselves, how hopeless the task of ever reaching the good society until the last judgment. No wonder that they retreated in a purely materialistic view of this world. No wonder that they came to believe, whether they were ranters or soul sleepers, that there were two worlds who were totally distinguished from each other, and it would only mean in some far distant time at the last judgment. If you have read Overton, you will know about this in detail. Just as I think for the Orthodox Church, the revolutionary struggle made a growing materialism almost inevitable. How much that I have to say is involved with the theory that I hold, and which Father Arnold has alluded to in the introduction, of the general terms of Christianity in the 17th century, is a very controversial addition. For I will hold from out of these studies, and I tell you this as simply my opinion of the past, that in the 17th century Christianity underwent its most crucial change, a change which I regard perhaps in the last resort even more crucial than the change in the 16th century, namely the change from removing Christian relevance to a future utopia. The 17th century is the beginning, in the sense, of modern materialism, and even the beginning of modern materialism from out of Christian thought itself. So that if you look back from the vantage point of 1961, you can make a case, it's rather unlimited, that the 17th century is more critical, that the 17th century, in a sense, leads to the final statement by President Eisenhower about the heads on the cloud, the feet on the ground, which is a statement which brings up, and something that I think the 16th century would not have given up on at all. The saints wanted to reach Jerusalem without tarrying, but in their longing to arrive at their Zion, many arrived instead at an earthly city which contained the seeds of that theism and materialism which their later successors were to lament with such good cause. Now, as I said at the beginning, this is a controversial thing. It stresses many historians who think of the 17th century as an age of faith, as it was in a sense, as well, the Pietistic revival, and if you're possibly going to show, you have to examine from this point of view too, sometimes. And I have done this. So, you must have questions. You must be a defender of truth. Yes. But there's one remark that I will make, because I didn't have time in the paper. You see, this was, I think, a very fascinating light upon apocalyptical thought. That apocalyptical thought, by its very apocalyptical nature, has these materialistic views. I think this is a very fascinating study. As I said, always need further investigation. If I have gotten some of you a little enthusiastic to go into this, I should be very happy. But I'm open to any questions that you might have. Yes, certainly. Yes, I do. Very much so. That's what they call it, that's that. Yes. Yes, that is the common term of that text. Yes, it is. The term materialism was not used in the 17th century. That's a much more modern term in this regard. They didn't call them materialists. But materialism seems to me a useful term to describe a development which does end up in what we generally call materialism. It's more complex than that. By which I meant, which I hope I have made clear, the view really of man and nature and the world in finite terms. Finitism would be better. But let me make the point about science. Because I'm very glad you asked that. And I have a thing about science. I don't believe it's half as important as it's made out. I think that this kind of development is more important. And do you know why? Because I think that if you get to the mountains and you get to popular thought, you get to the thought of the people themselves. These radicals, these were the unlettered. This was popular thought. There has never been a book on examination that I know on popular deism, on popular thought of the Enlightenment. We like to say that the Enlightenment, like some say about the Renaissance, I think it's possible to tell it about the Renaissance. Remember, he said the Renaissance is a Sunday dress. And we think about the Enlightenment and deism and so on as a Sunday dress. But my research has led me to believe that it may not be a Sunday dress at all. And therefore, from this point of view, if you want to get at popular piety, which is really one of my overriding interests, you see, get a certain historical moment, popular thought, the thought of the unlettered, the thought of the unintellectual, and then I think this development is much more important than any development of science. Now, I'm not saying you don't have to discuss Hobbes and Bacon and the usual kind of thing. Well, we've been rather tired. I mean, all right, everybody does it. But that doesn't really get you much further, I think, in the end. I think you've got to get down to the level of popular thought. And I think the Rantan, and above all this text which goes on since Calvin's time, and nobody's ever written about it, I don't want to correct you, but I insist I'm going to have anybody. It's all true. There are thousands of them. Young Calvin, who certainly Calvin didn't raise his son, you know, he knew what he wanted. I mean, you know, he didn't raise his son. Wrote a tract, a big tract against the soul sleepers. He thought the soul sleepers were that important, even in Calvin's time. And the soul sleepers go on, and I've made an examination, personally, examination of heresy trials under Elizabeth and under James. And do you know what you find? You find that most of those tribes were soul sleepers. They were tribes for advocating the mortality of the soul until the last judgment. And of course, that is implied there, I hope I have made clear. The soul sleepers is a kind of popular thought whose importance, I am convinced, is very great. It's very difficult to get at. You just got to read heresy trials. That's the only way you can get it. And for some reason, it isn't clear to me. Well, I could make some remarks now, but you don't feel sorry for it, but I won't. For some reason, you know, these people, I mean, they talk about Magna Carta and law, and Magna Carta and law, and I even wrote a book about it in my youth, unfortunately. I think this is all, it is now much too much now. I think we in current school history, much as late as generation now. We've got to do what difference we do. After all, here's an important book on knowledge of the English Reformation. That is, get down to heresy trials, get down to this kind of evidence, which only Father Jules has examined,
And Father, here's in this examination tonight with another revolutionary thing, British, that after all, these people who are condemned by two laws were mostly Anabaptists. Why become Anabaptists? So that the English historians can no longer say, as they last said, that these things never came over here. You see. What kind of examination that opens to the just a new book out, it makes that point again, unfortunately. The kind of thing that Father Jewish said, draws our sins out of fruitful veins now, in that kind of thing. Now, I thought it just gave him no, you see, this is interesting, you know, there is a false pluralism in things which is purely materialistic, if I may use this term for convenience for a minute. No, you see, what's interesting is that all the things I've told you that are a kind of fusion. You see, the Christian end is there, but it's pushed out of this world until the last judgment. You will not find among these heretics, right? Because I've just begun to examine them, you know, so that I'm subject to questioning. You will find mostly soul sleepers. No, not so much the other. Yes, please.
Have you examined some of the 1600
No, I have not. No, that's what we've always done. No, I've looked into the Mennonite scholarship and I talked to Professor Bender about this too, because I thought this is where you'd find it. No, that isn't quite true. No. And the problem does not attack many people there by name. It's apparently, it is a lower class movement, and a very widespread lower class movement. That's really right to see. How you would get at it, I don't know. I hope one day I have a good PhD student who can just go through the long and go through the local archives. And there might be an awful lot in the local archives. I just don't know, you see. I mean, there are many phenomena we don't know about in this regard, but you'd have to go through the local office. I'm not saying anything like that, I'm interested in getting other things, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. In a sense, this is true, but this is true, somewhat. For this reason, if this is a lower class movement, these people don't hear nominalism, you know, any more than our freshmen do. I don't know. No, this is a lower class movement, we're not going to get very far with that. I think, and I hope I made that clear in the paper, but I think personally, this is again a hand speaker, that they came to this because actually this was in the situation, basically. The glory of God in their own so wretched position is a much simpler explanation, makes more sense than I think, than that they have read, you know, nominalist writers and so on, because they haven't. In Madison and Reed, you see, if you go through their work, then citations like that, these people were illiterate. I mean, that way. Yes. Yes, very much. Very much. Now, I know, it's not a medieval heresy, but it's also was in the Middle Ages. And if it was so, then I think it would be a very important task to undertake by a group of scholars, to work out this kind of heresy. Because this particular kind of heresy not only illuminates popular thought, which we historians always want to get at, you see, but I think it also becomes very important for certain 19th and 20th century trends. And it's not a mirror, I don't even know why. Is there something on the medieval world? Rather, all of it knows better than
that. This is not the entire time, yeah. I mean, but just a lot of curious coincidence about this last question. A series of coincidences. Yesterday, Peter Martyr, Peter Martyr the Negro, the man Italian that came to England, today happens to be the feast of St. Peter. The martyr, he was the man that's known as named after the saint from St. Peter the Apostle. The Austin in the brewery today notes that his father and mother, he was a contemporary of St. Thomas, his father and mother are described as Manichaeans. No, but let me remark,
I think the most useful thing that I could do here is because I didn't have enough time for details thoroughly, I mean to document this still more, is to make a plea to all of you to concern yourselves with these things. Because I do think that in the early modern period, this is the kind of trend that we now got to get after. Let's forget for a while about Parliament.
It will start anyway.
Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean
really the law of classes in this case. They would usually be what you would call Roman class. There is no class analysis either ever be more than the church. Because you know people dash aside the church. They're not important, that's really common. But it's a better known one, you know. But the no social analysis doesn't make a sense. But from what I can gather, there are two, they would be what you would call the yeoman class, and what is below the yeoman class. This would not affect, by and large, as far as I can tell, your tribulation, you think like that. It might have affected, however, to a certain extent, the land of apprentices. If somebody ever gets into an up and makes an examination of the apprentice revolt, of whom there are quite a few, his class would be part of the. In other words, this may be, you see, in the end, a revolutionary dynamic. Yes, we can. I can't answer that at all because I know nothing about such contemporary movements of this nature. My interest is how this becomes a revolutionary dynamic, how it really fits in with the modern turn towards materialism, if you don't have anything that way. I suppose I'm under the handicap of what some historians think in present-mindedness, but I agree with Croce. That everything has to pass through this mind of a historian, therefore only a vivid interest in the present makes one investigate the past.
Yes, sir.
To a certain extent, I would say yes. To a certain extent, by mid-century, by about 46 to 47, the concrete would be a rather alarmed, I would say.
Yes.
To the degree it's so difficult for me to say, you know. But you do find people being alarmed, and you do find people appearing attendance, you know, because I'll just put one example from Darling because it's a telling, the new issue of it's a telling, but there are quite a few more.
I don't recall anything there, but a thing that pops into my mind is when John Evelyn, a character of England, which is written as though it were the product of a French ambassador in England reporting to his king, the